Check the internet list for the top 50 or 100 geniuses of all time. You'll be surprised at the names you find. What do the experts who study geniuses have to say about this? It's Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Nebbe. Author Dean Simonton says most of the variation in greatness corresponds to actual creative achievement. So you can't just be smart, you have to actually accomplish something. This hour I'll talk to Simonton. And later we'll head back to 1946, the year that author Richard C. Carpenter says was a high point for railroads in the U.S., with rail lines connecting practically every town and a caboose behind every freight train. Talk of Iowa after the news. It's Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Nebbe. Dean Simonton has been fascinated with the question of what is true genius for a long time. The University of California Davis psychology professor says he's most interested in what he calls Big C creativity or creative genius. He says that is a level where there is exceptional achievement that changes history. Simonton, who was in Iowa City recently, is the author of Origins of Genius and Genius 101. Welcome, Dean, to Talk of Iowa. It's very nice to have you here.
It's great to be here.
You're here for a few days in Iowa City, lecturing to classes and very busy schedule. Right. Author of Genius 101. Many books you've written. Genius 101 came out, a couple of years ago?
Yeah, 2009.
And you've been very interested in the concept and the idea of what makes a genius for a long time, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. It really goes back to, since I was an undergraduate and a graduate student, I've always been fascinated with people who make an incredible contribution to a field, whether it be science or art or politics, religion even. And so it's always been a fascination because these people they seem remarkable, but the question is whether they really are and whether we can become geniuses as well.
Okay, I guess I'll ask you that right now. Can we become a genius if we set our mind to it?
I think everybody has the potential of becoming a genius. These people are not necessarily super bright. They don't necessarily score really high on IQ tests. What they do have is a lot of motivation. They're willing to put in a lot of hard work. But most importantly, they find what their thing is, what their primary interest is, where their talents lie. And then they devote their lives to basically realizing that potential. And a lot of us never reach that point. We never find the thing that we can do. Or maybe we can find the thing we do really well, but it's not something that would be considered an area where you can become a genius. I mean, if you become a tiddlywink player, and you may be the best tiddlywink player in the world, but we usually don't consider tiddlywink players to be geniuses. You have to do something in an area of achievement like science or art or politics or some other area where it seems like this is something really special, a lasting contribution.
Are there more geniuses in the sciences or the arts then?
It's easier to be a genius in the arts because, let's put it this way, you don't have to do the same kind of training that you have to do in the sciences. You have to take all the math courses and take a lot of really hard science courses to finally get to the level where you have the expertise that enables you to do something in the sciences. Whereas artists, a lot of that expertise can be acquired on the side. You can do things. A lot of writers, for example, they have no formal training in writing. A lot of artists have no formal training in painting or sculpture. They may work with somebody for a while or get the training some other way. They may do a lot of imitation. A lot of jazz musicians will listen to recordings of other jazz musicians. And so you can do more self-learning in the arts than you can in the sciences.
Does IQ have much to do with it? Because I've seen these lists, and we'll talk about this later, of geniuses past and present. Right. And a lot of times these people somehow manage to come up with their IQ scores. I don't know how you do this with someone who has been dead for 200 years, but some people have managed to take a stab at it anyway.
Well, let me just explain that first. It's obviously just an estimate. It's conjectural. But what some researchers have done is take detailed biographies of famous people and basically formed a chronology of when they learned to do certain things or when they did certain things. So when did they first start reading? When did they first start writing? And what is the normal age that someone would do that? So if you have someone like John Stuart Mill, who wrote A History of Rome at 5 1/2.
He really did?
He really did.
Oh, gosh.
The question you have to ask yourself is, at what age would you normally expect a person to write A History of Rome?
Was it accurate?
Oh, yeah. And he had amazing knowledge. And in fact, there was one time when I think he was 6 or 7. There was this one party he was at when he was a little boy, and he got in an argument with an adult over who was the greater general, Marlborough or I forget who the other one was. But the very fact that he could, you know, do this, he had an IQ over 200.
So it's possible to have an IQ over 200?
Yes, right.
Okay.
And in fact, in the Guinness Book of Records, they don't have this category anymore, but in the 1980s and 1990s, they had the category of who has the highest recorded IQ. And it was Marilyn Vos Savant, who she's a journalist who does an article in Parade magazine.
Well, I've noticed John Stuart Mill made most of the lists I've checked. I didn't realize that. And a lot of it, as you say, he started at a very young age. So I assume that people can sort of get the idea if you're going to be a genius or not when you're quite young.
Right.
And on the opposite end, it's probably hard to become a genius at age 50-something then, right?
Right. Although occasionally you do have late bloomers, people who don't really find their thing until relatively late in life. You know, they are floating around from one thing to another, and then they discover that they're in the wrong field. They change fields and make their most important contribution in an entirely new area. So, I mean, when you think of an example, that is like Grandma Moses, who mm-hmm. didn't discover painting until she was relatively old, and now is part of the history of American art.
Yeah. So it's possible to be quite creative even at an older age.
Yeah, at an older age. And in fact, usually those people who start earlier, they may, peter out sooner as well. Not necessarily, but they can. And so what happens is sometimes when someone starts later, their whole trajectory just shifted. So there's this Austrian composer, Anton Bruckner, who didn't start composing symphonies until he was 40. So his best work started to appear when he was in his 70s and 80s.
Okay.
So it just shifted.
You write, Professor Simon Ten, creativity may take many forms as well, only one of which has any connection with genius, namely genius-level creativity. In some, you can have geniuses who aren't creators, creators who aren't geniuses, and creators who are also geniuses.
Right. Well, the term genius is something that's, I think, acquired too many definitions from the one I prefer. Like, one of the definitions is just a high IQ. That's actually in the American Heritage Dictionary. They define a genius as someone who has an IQ of 140 or above on an IQ test. And that is fine and dandy, but the problem is that there's no evidence that someone who has an IQ that high necessarily is a genius by the other criterion, and that is you actually make a contribution to a field. Like the example of Marilyn Vos Savant, she has an IQ of, I think it's 223, and that's very high, but she hasn't done anything that's even close to what an Albert Einstein has produced, who wasn't nearly as bright as she was.
Yeah, how can you say that? I was shocked to see that Einstein comes down further on some of the lists. I don't know, just assuming he would be number one.
Well, in terms of achievement,
yeah,
he is number one. I mean, he was the man of the century on the cover of Time magazine, and his contributions revolutionized physics, and he also became a major figure in popular media. He became almost a universal wise man, whether you thought he was wise or not. If you look at his education performance, if you look at even his basic knowledge of physics, it was relatively deficient in comparison to a lot of other theoretical physicists of his time. He was not the most expert theoretical physicist of his day. And in fact, later on in his career, he realized he didn't know enough mathematics to develop his theories, so he had to take on a mathematical collaborator to do the math for him. So, you know, he wasn't really as bright. I mean, in comparison to us, I mean, this, you know, it's a whole other issue, but he's not by far. Like, for example, Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb, has a claim to be far more brilliant than Albert Einstein, but who is a greater physicist.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking to Professor Dean Simonton. He teaches at the University of California, Davis. He's in Iowa City speaking to groups at the University of Iowa. His latest book, it is your latest book, right? Genius 101?
Oh, no. I have other books coming out. And
coming out, not...
I also have a book called Great Flicks that came out in 2011, if you're interested in movies.
Okay. So you've had a big interest in movies and, I guess, extending that idea of genius to filmmakers.
Right.
Why has this been of interest to you?
Well, the thing that happened is I teach a course on genius, creativity, and leadership, and students have to write a paper on manifestations of genius in various areas. And I had one student come to me and said that he wanted to do a term paper on genius in cinema. And I started thinking about it, and I realized there is no research on genius in cinema.
Now somebody had to do it.
Somebody had to do it. Part of the reason why is cinema departs from the way genius normally operates. We think of genius as being this solitary individual, like Einstein working on his relativity theory or Picasso working on his Guernica. But in the case of film, there's no way it cannot be collaborative. You have to have a producer and a director and a screenwriter and a cinematographer and everything else that goes into film. If one of those components doesn't go right, the whole film bombs. There's a recent example in film, The Consular, got A-list director, A-list actors and actresses in it, but people feel that the screenwriter wrote a screenplay that was not good for film. It may be a great literary piece, but it didn't make good dialogue for film, and that sunk the boat.
So who is the greatest genius in film?
Well, that's kind of hard to say. I mean, my own personal prejudice is Orson Welles.
Oh, yeah,
because The Citizen Kane was an incredibly bold film. It was really revolutionary at the time, and he had his hands in it in several levels. He co-wrote the screenplay. He, of course, was the key actor, and of course, he was the director. And he also was able to recruit some really first-rate people. Cinematography, for example, was state-of-the-art, which is really kind of surprising because he had very little experience in filmmaking. He came from radio.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll talk more. We need to take a quick break. Yeah. I'm talking to Dean Simonton, a professor of psychology at the University of California, Davis. His book of a couple of years ago is called Genius 101. He's speaking on the University of Iowa campus. Talk of Iowa continues in a minute. Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese, filling in today for Charity Nebbe, and I'm speaking with Dean Simonton. He teaches psychology at the University of California, Davis, author of many, many, many books, many of those books about the idea of creativity, including Genius 101. And we were talking before the break about Dean's interest in cinema and the genius in cinema and how difficult it is to define genius in filmmaking because it's such a collaborative process. But Orson Welles, we were talking about before the break, there's no question that he was a genius, although I don't see his name on some of these internet lists. In fact, the one that pops up most often on the internet in the film category would be Steven Spielberg.
Oh, yeah, and there's no doubt that Steven Spielberg is the greatest contemporary example of cinematic genius.
You agree with that?
Oh, I agree with that. And in some respects, he was more successful because you have, on the one hand, you have someone who is critically acclaimed, like Orson Welles was, but was never really a financial success as a filmmaker, whereas Spielberg is basically that epitomizes what it means to have box office success. But one thing interesting about it is that Spielberg, unlike Orson Welles, isn't involved in all the various aspects. He's not involved in the writing. He's not involved in the acting. You know, it's not like Spike Lee, who's more like Orson Welles, who does it all. He focuses on the direction production side of it and has that down pat.
Well, Dean, it's interesting to look at the number of scholars over the years who have written about creativity. You mentioned that the first person really to write about it in depth was one Francis Galton, who wrote in 1869 a book called Hereditary Genius about, I guess, nurture versus nature. Was that the sort of things he was looking at?
Yeah, he was the person who first suggested that, at least in a scientific way, that genius is born, not made. And he tried to prove in this book, by I can tell from the title, Hereditary Genius, that it was born, not made. And the way he did it is he looked at family pedigrees and showed that geniuses in a wide range of fields. He looked at the sciences, the arts, he looked at politics, and he showed that geniuses in a wide range of fields tend to come from distinguished family lines. He interpreted that as evidence for genetics. But of course, you could say if you come from a very distinguished family, you also have a much superior environment to the average person on the street as well.
Mm-hmm.
It was also a little bit self-serving because he himself came from a distinguished family. He was related to Darwin.
To Darwin, a cousin.
He actually mentions in the book, I could mention a few other people who are related to the Darwin family who count as geniuses. He's obviously referring to himself.
And, of course, Darwin had to be considered a genius.
Oh, yeah. And Darwin is really a prime example of that family pedigree because his grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, was a very distinguished scientist. Yeah. And then Darwin himself had sons who were all knighted, who are very distinguished scientists as well, a distinguished biologist, a distinguished engineer, and a distinguished Cambridge physicist. But it was also a very whale-heeled family. His father was very wealthy. He could get in the best education. Darwin went to Cambridge University. So it's heavily environmental as well. And in fact, just a few years after that book came out, one of the families that was featured in there, a Belgian family of scientists that went back several generations, challenged Galton's book and argued that it was entirely environmental, that it was nurture, not nature.
I was surprised.
Yeah, it was a guy named Alphonse Condol, and he came from a very distinguished family and was actually in the family was mentioned in Galton's book. But he wasn't buying it, and he said, I came from a very privileged background and gave me opportunities that, and he then documented it.
Hmm.
So this is an issue that we've been fighting about.
And we're still debating that, right?
Yeah, we're still debating
what's
that.
What's the latest thoughts on?
Well, one of the things we know for sure is on the one side, behavior geneticists have documented that almost every trait on which individuals can vary, whether it be cognitive or whether it be personality, has a strong genetic component. There's just no way of escaping it.
Mm-hmm.
There are very, very high heritability coefficients. For example, most personality traits, about half of the variance in personality is due to genetics. And then the other half is due to some kind of environmental experience. On the other hand, there's tremendous amount of research, a lot of conducted by myself, showing that environmental factors play a major role. Family background does play a role. Education plays a role. There's a lot of research showing that acquiring necessary expertise in your field. A lot of people may have heard of Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours notion that you have to spend 10,000 hours practicing or learning before you can finally make a world-class contribution to some field. And there's some partial truth to that as well. It's probably a combination. You need a certain talent, but you have to develop that talent. You have to acquire the expertise for that talent to materialize.
Well, I have to say, I got such a kick out of looking at these lists. I went to the internet. Of course, everything on the internet is true. We know. There's so many lists, Dean, of the top 100 geniuses of all time, top 150 living geniuses, deceased geniuses. And I'm sure you've seen these lists. One thing I was taken by the number of chess aficionados who made the list. Chess players seem to crop up. Garry Kasparov and others. And the number one genius of all time varies from list to list. On the china.org listserv of geniuses, number one, turned out to be Stephen Hawking.
Huh, interesting. And this must be living ones.
This is a living list, yes, yeah. Yes, sorry. And then on the Guardian newspaper in England, number one was Tim Berners-Lee. So what's the number one that you've run into the most often? And now it's not going to be Einstein. We've talked about that. Who's number one, living and dead?
Besides Albert Einstein.
Besides Einstein.
Probably Isaac Newton.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is this tendency to see someone. Well, part of this has to do is a bias. Are you inclined to see scientists or artists?
Right.
As being the greatest exemplars of genius. A lot of people have felt that just the sheer mathematical intellectual brilliance of Isaac Newton was unsurpassed. It was even unsurpassed by Albert Einstein. A lot of people don't realize that Albert Einstein never contributed to mathematics. He was a pure theoretical physicist.
Yeah.
And he was an experimental scientist. Newton was a great theoretical physicist. He was a great experimenter in his optics, and he made major contributions to mathematics. I mean, the calculus is no mean contribution. You know, your creativity. In fact, it's interesting. There's one philosopher, Immanuel Kant, who dismissed that you could ever have genius in science because it was so restricted by logic that there was no room for creativity.
Mm-hmm.
That, according to Kant, you could only have creativity in the arts. So, according to that notion, then you have someone like Michelangelo,
mm-hmm.
or maybe Leonardo da Vinci.
I would say the person that turns up number one that I noticed the most, and I certainly would agree maybe with this, is Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. He turns up number one. Of course, this is a writer and philosopher.
And scientist.
What about musicians? Because I don't see a lot of musicians on these lists. Maybe I'm just looking at
different. Well, part of that is that a lot of people, you know, there's different preferences. People have different stylistic preferences. And so if you like classical music, then you almost always see Beethoven, Bach, and Mozart at the top of the list, particularly
yeah.
Mozart, because Mozart was also a child prodigy. So he sort of gets to be a genius two ways. But then if your tastes go in some other direction, it may be Jimi Hendrix or some other person, depending on what your particular stylistic preferences are. That's where the arts are different than the sciences, because we don't have stylistic preferences in the sciences. You don't say, well, I'm more of a Newtonian than this. You know, you either like science or you don't like science. If you like science, then you got to accept that Newton was a genius.
There was one list that showed up that connected every genius with various mind-altering substances that they use. Now, but this does bring up the question on whether there's sort of a connection between madness and genius.
Right. I mean, that's one of the oldest issues. It was actually Aristotle who first suggested that geniuses, he didn't use the term genius, he talked about people who made major contributions to various fields. And including philosophy in this, because he was a philosopher, separate from the term he used was melancholy.
Yeah.
We would call it depression. And people have been speculating on this for a number of years. Turns out the empirical research shows it has some grain of truth. Like I have a study right now where I demonstrate there is definitely a relationship. But the problem is that the relationship is very complex. For example, it varies according to field. The rates of psychopathology are much higher in the arts mm-hmm. than it is in the sciences. And sometimes you get sort of these curvilinear relationships where it's like this optimal level. And then if you go beyond that point, then it has a negative impact on you. And so it turns out to be very complicated. But there was actually some really good research published by a researcher here at Iowa. Nancy Andreasen.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, and she's done some recent follow-ups on this. And she's found really good evidence that she was looking at people at the Iowa Writers Workshop. There's definitely an increased vulnerability. I'm not going to say you're mentally ill. It's increased vulnerability towards mental illness. And we've even gotten some idea of why. Because it turns out that the mentally ill and the highly creative share certain characteristics that for the creative people turn into assets and for the people who have mental illness turn into liabilities. For example, both the highly creative and the mentally ill have problems filtering out extraneous information. Mm. They'll allow things to come into their thoughts that most people would filter out. That's fine and dandy, but a lot of times you filter out stuff that is innovative, you know, serendipitous discovery. And for the creative people, they're able to exploit that. For the people who suffer from mental illness, they feel like they're bombarded and overwhelmed by this stuff. There's just too much coming in.
This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Nebbe, talking to Dean Simonton, author of Genius 101. Dean, are there golden ages of genius, just certain periods in history where geniuses just sprouted up and there were more than you could even count? And then are there certain dark ages where there aren't many?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually what I did my doctoral dissertation on many, many years ago. I actually got my degree in social psychology. I was interested in the social aspect of creative genius. One of the problems is that there are periods in history, in particular times and places, where geniuses disappear. There was a period well, we even call it the Dark Ages in European history, where the greatest genius of the time was just somebody who wrote this encyclopedia that was based on already established knowledge, making not one single new contribution. His name was Isidore Seville. And there was not a single original idea in that. And he was the greatest mind of his time.
What year was that?
It was around 700 AD.
Yeah.
And so it was in the pit of the Dark Ages. And of course, then on the other hand, you have like the Golden Age of Greece, particularly of Athens. One person has estimated the per capita output of geniuses there, because we're talking about a relatively small city at that time. Athens was a relatively small town, and yet on a per capita basis, it was producing some of the greatest minds in philosophy, in art, in literature, and so forth. And then, of course, then it disappeared. Athens became a backwater, and the center of creativity moved elsewhere to Rome, and writing in Latin, and then later on to Western Europe, and so forth. And so there is definitely a tendency for genius to cluster into certain golden ages. They usually last no more than a century, and then it dies out. Hmm. And then the center moves someplace else. There's always somewhere on the planet some golden age happening sometime. Like even in the Dark Age of Europe, Islamic civilization was producing, just across the Mediterranean, super great minds in architecture and science and literature, philosophy, and so forth. And similarly, on the other side of the Eurasian continent, in China, China was going through this great golden age with the Tang Dynasty.
And what about today? Is this a golden age?
I think we're living in a golden age. It's kind of hard to appreciate the golden age we're living in because we have, on the one hand, some forms of creativity have become less important, and other forms of creativity have taken their place. And so sometimes it's hard to appreciate it. Sometimes it takes a while to realize that. I mean, a good example is that in Elizabethan times, plays were considered a popular form of entertainment. They weren't really considered literature. You know, Shakespeare's plays were not published until long after his death, when they started realizing, hey, you know, this is actually literature. This is actually, you know, masterworks. And similar thing is happening to film. Initially, it was just a form of entertainment. And now people are realizing film is the major art form of the 20th century. Now, the question is whether it will continue in the 21st. And then we have other things like video game. Have video games become the art form of the 21st century? So in retrospect, people look back and say, whoa, look at the latter part of the 20th and early part of the 21st century. These amazing technologies emerged that just revolutionized the way people live. But it's sometimes hard to know that when you're right in the midst of it, who the geniuses are.
As I was just assuming that the geniuses would be in tech.
Right.
Today,
you know, like Steve Jobs, you know.
Yeah, right.
Classical
and
example. It's fair to say that there are golden ages in some areas that perhaps are more distant from us. Classical music, I don't think we'll ever have a Beethoven or even a Bach again.
You write, Dean, exceptional achievement seems the most useful measure, measuring genius. It's what you've actually accomplished, achieved, written, composed, discovered. That's the bottom line.
Right. And that's why, by that definition, there cannot be any neglected geniuses. People often talk about neglected geniuses, but it's an oxymoron to say that. If you haven't made a contribution, then it's because you deserve to be neglected in a way. Now, there's some fuzzy middle areas people will point out, and I agree that they exist. You have someone like Emily Dickinson, who was neglected in her own lifetime, but that was partly her choice. She realized she couldn't compose her poems the way she wanted them to be. They were heavily edited. She had a very nasty experience with heavy editing because she was too innovative for the time. At that time, American poetry was too conventional. But when she died, fortunately, she had some relatives and friends who said, you know, we got to round this stuff up and publish it. And now she's not neglected anymore.
Well, we're out of time. This has been really fun talking to you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much. I've been talking to Dean Simonton. He's a professor of psychology at the University of California, Davis. He's been in Iowa City. One of his current books is Genius 101. That's the focus of some of these seminars here in Iowa City. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Talk of Iowa continues in a minute.